I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, Aaron Moore, is the author of That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. She grew up in South Florida, Key West, Florida, actually, and she worked at Botham for a while and edited the writings of some British writers. She now lives, she went to King's College for a while as well as in Harvard. So she really has this American English life going for her. And she's been living in London for 8 years now. Her husband grew up in England. Her children are growing up in England, and they seem to be much more British than she. It's a really interesting book. She is a former editor at Gotham Books, and what she did was listen very carefully to the language that was being used, the words that were being used, and she picked up words for which American English has no real equivalent and uses some of those words now in her vocabulary. But what she's done is put together a book, and each chapter in the book is about a single word that tells us about the relationship between English and American culture. She started with 100 words and had to go down from there. She went to the London Library, the British Library, to newspapers, TV, art, comedy, and turned up so many amusing little stories, and the book is filled with them and facts that really brought the subject alive. And so that's what we're talking about this hour of the program, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Aaron. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Aaron. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks, Kathleen. I'm happy to be on the show today.
Yeah, great to have you here. You know, I found this very interesting, and you really have a sense of what both countries are now because you've lived in both of them and studied them. I found this sentence very interesting. A former book editor, you're the former book editor. Somebody said to you, I don't know if it was a former book editor, that English, the English may have more culturally and temperamentally in common with the Japanese than they do with Americans, which I found a very interesting statement. Do you agree with that?
You know, I found that a startling statement when my friend said it to me. He's a former banker who's traveled extensively in Asia and is English and married to an American. So I feel like he knows what he's talking about. I've never been to Japan, but we were having coffee and he said to me, you know, I think that it's so hard for an American to figure out how to survive in Britain at first, because actually you're thinking that the British have a lot in common with you since we share a language, but actually the British culturally are more like the Japanese than they are like Americans. I told Peter, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, the thing is that the Japanese concept of politeness to other human beings is to leave them alone and not get in their business. And that is how the British are. Whereas for Americans, when we're being polite, if we want to be kind to someone, we're trying to be inclusive. We try to draw them in. We tell them our life story. We listen to theirs. You know, so he said that actually, as a British person, he feels much more comfortable in Japan than he does in America.
Isn't that fascinating? We do reveal so much, and we do it with very loud voices at times, don't we?
Well, that's certainly how I was raised to be, and when I first moved to London, I didn't understand that I wasn't actually being polite by doing that, and it took me a while to learn to tone it down, although I do still really embrace who I am. I haven't changed that much. I think my friends would say that I haven't.
Well, you write about the Americans tend to be a little bit more effusive. We pour out more of our life stories. We're engaging with other people, more reserved the British are. And does our language significantly reflect that?
Oh, definitely. Yes. Well, there's one word in particular. One chapter in the book is really about this. We all know that the British have a reputation for being understaters, and Americans have a reputation for being more effusive. And I think that's a generalization about the two countries that is mostly true. But the word that really brings this to light is the word quite. So as Americans, if we really like something, we'll say, oh, I quite liked that film or that book. And I think that our enthusiasm really comes across when we say that. I don't think we're confusing anyone when we say that. But when the British say that they quite like something, they say it in sort of a less effusive way, sort of a monotone. I quite like that book. And for 5 years of living there, I thought that that was just them being a bit understated, and they were really saying that they liked it as much as I did. And what it turns out that they're damning it with faint praise. I quite like it in England means I don't like it at all. It means, you know, I'm barely even being polite about it. it took me 5 years to figure that out.
And you talk about this young woman who was trying to get a job, I believe, somewhere in England, and somebody had sent a reference saying, well, she's quite intelligent. And no wonder she wasn't finding work, because the word quite was used instead of she's extraordinarily intelligent, she's at the top of her game, or whatever.
I have a friend who was actually a clerk in the Supreme Court. She's so good and qualified, and she had done some graduate work for law in England, and her professors wrote her what passes in England for very effusive recommendation letters. And she couldn't even use them for jobs in America. It was a little bit of a disaster, because she realized that reading them, people would think that they didn't like her very much, when actually, you know, I think she was rather a favorite of theirs. Just the way they wrote about her just didn't sound to an American like praise.
Let's talk a little bit about your daughter. I don't know if it's Annie or Anne. Do you call her?
Oh, Anne.
Anne.
Yes.
She's 4 years old, you say in the book, probably a little older now. But here you have this daughter. You're still American, and you don't have much of a trace of a British accent, I must say. But your daughter, on the other hand, it must be strange for you to be raising this child who in many ways is British.
Yes. Well, when my husband and I moved to England, we didn't have children yet. And I think that we like the idea of having children in England, because we like, especially London, it's a nice quiet city compared to New York, where we were before, and we thought it'd be a great place to be, and it is. But we thought we were going to be raising American children in England. And as soon as my daughter at 2.5 went off to nursery school, I realized that I was going to be raising an English child. And that is something I never anticipated and have found so strange, because as soon as she went to school, she adopted all of the cultural references and even the accent of her peers. So I have had to come to terms with being corrected by small children all the time. I have the vocabulary of a book editor and a literature major, and my child is always telling me I'm just saying it wrong. I think a lot of parents have this experience. I find it very discombobulating.
I'm sure. And she speaks as a British person would, right?
She does. And what's a little funny about that is, of course, in America, when we speak, many times you can tell what part of the country we came from, not always, but sometimes you can by our accents. But what we don't have as much as the British have is the class-based accent. There's a tiny bit of that, and I think regionally we can pick each other out a little bit. If, for example, you're from the South, like my mother, you can tell the different Southern accents apart. But for the most part, Americans don't really do that to each other with their accents, whereas a British person, even today, who opens his mouth immediately classifies himself. It's not quite as strict as that world of My Fair Lady, but that still exists. And I think a lot of Americans are surprised to find that out. And so what my dilemma raising an English child is that, on the one hand, I don't want her to be a snob about this. I don't want her to absorb the snobbery about what someone's accent or word choices say about him or her. But I would like her to have the skills to play that game if she needs to. For example, if she wants to get into a good school, or she wants to get a job in certain industries, I think later it will really matter what kind of accent she has.
Absolutely.
And because I can't give her that, I have to, I have to find a way for her to figure that out for herself.
Well, she can get a job in American television, because we keep hiring all these Brits, right?
Isn't that the truth? I know.
It's weird. What's that all about?
The media's been taken over. Well, what's funny is, in England, the world of journalism is such a pressure cooker. They have so many more national newspapers of note than we have these days, even though the country is a fifth the size. They have sort of five times the number of daily newspapers that are national. So they have a very competitive world over there, and there, of course, the BBC turns out world-class journalists, famously, and a lot of people end up wanting to dip a toe in across the pond and see what our world of journalism is like. So with the result that I have a list of it in my book, but so many people who are running American magazines, TV shows,
yes,
newspapers, they're all British.
Yeah, I know. It's quite something. I like the fact that you, and I always like to learn new words, that you wouldn't know that you've lived in England for the last 8 years. I must tell you that you haven't a trace, at least that I have been able to discern yet, but I'll keep my ears open. But you tend to pick up words for which American English has no real equivalent, and I like that. You include the book in the book, and this is a good word to use, Moorish. Moorish, something you want more of, Moorish.
Yes, that's one of my absolute favorites. So I always worry that if I take on too many British locutions, I'm going to sound like someone on her junior year abroad, which is something that I did during college, and many of us sort of embarrassingly picked up traces of a British accent. And these days, you know, I'm almost 40. I am who I am. I really need to embrace who I am and not try to be anyone else. I think people could tell anyway if I did. I'm not much of a mimic. But Moorish is such a fantastic word, and I think that Americans need to adopt this word, because Moorish refers, as you say, to something that you want more of, and nothing implies the hand in the snack packet more than this word to me. Moorish, you know, something's Moorish, you know, you're stealing the last brownie in the break room, you finish that bag of chips that you meant to share with the children, that's what the word is really about. There's another word about snacking, the word snaffling. And if I snaffle something, I eat it quickly and greedily and without permission, which is a great thing.
Yeah, I like that. I didn't know that the British eat twice as much chocolate as Americans. Isn't that something?
Can you believe it?
No, that's amazing.
My jaw dropped when I read that. I had a suspicion for quite a while that the British sweet tooth was a sweeter sweet tooth than the American one. And no one believes me, British or American, when I say this, but it is true. The sweets in England are sweeter. Savory things are sweeter. When you go to a restaurant, you are much more likely to find a fruit sauce with a meat. It is, people really like their sweets over there, and they serve lots more. I feel like they eat more ketchup than us. There's just so much sweet sauce going on over there. But, yes, and adults eat candy a lot more than my friends in America do. Many of my friends in America are quite health conscious, and while they might polish off half a bottle of wine with dinner, they certainly wouldn't go around eating a candy bar. But most British adults that I know do eat quite a lot of candy, and I find that really great. It's a really endearing quality of the British.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind that.
No, and their chocolate is made quite differently from ours. Even the Cadbury branded chocolate in America is different from the Cadbury branded chocolate in England. There's a process that American chocolate is put through, and American chocolate has less milk and more sugar. So the chocolates taste quite different, and the British people can be really mean about American chocolate. But having grown up with it myself, I tend to prefer it.
The American chocolate?
Yes. Give me M&M's over Smarties any day, which are the British version of M&M's. I think it's just what you grew up with, that you have these childhood associations. And although I don't eat much candy, when I do, I kind of want American candy.
Ooh, and for me, give me a Cadbury milk chocolate bar made in England, and I'm in heaven.
Well, yes. Did you hear that Hershey's recently won a lawsuit that is going to prevent British Cadbury bars from being imported by small shops in the way that they are now?
Oh, no.
Yes.
Well, it's terrible.
Hershey's has the right to produce all Cadbury-branded chocolate in America, and they do it according to their own methods, not the British recipe. And so they got upset because they noticed all these small specialty stores importing the British versions, and it was a copyright infringement. And I think it's really rather sour of them, because I don't think that any of these little shops were importing enough chocolate to make a dent in their business.
Absolutely.
Especially since the people who want the British kind really don't want the American kind. I don't think they're going to buy more of it just because they can't get what they really want.
Yeah, well, just fill your pockets with a British kind when you come over, and you can sell it on the side, Erin.
I brought a suitcase. I took it to my reading. I took it to my book party. It all went. I don't have any more left. Which is just as well, because my next tour stop is Florida, and everything would melt anyway.
Yeah, it would. We're going to welcome phone calls and emails and Facebook messages and all of that. Erin Moore is our guest. That's Not English is her book, and it's more than just, you know, the description of words and differences and words that exist here that don't exist there, and how our words may indicate that we're a more effusive people generally than the Brits tend to be. It also would have to delve into cultural differences, class differences, history, etc., which it does in a very amusing fashion. That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, and we're on Facebook, too, The Kathleen Dunn Show, so leave a message there. We'd like to hear from you. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls for the author of That's Not English. Erin Moore is with us, and we go to John in Glendale for our first call. Erin, hi, John.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Erin. I wanted to ask Erin about a line I heard on Downton Abbey. Shirley MacLaine was expressing to Maggie Smith how tough she is. She says, don't worry about me, have a gun, we'll travel. And I thought that originated with the Western TV series in the 50s, but Downton Abbey takes place before, well, it doesn't take place before the Western time, but you know what I mean? When it was written, it took place after Have Gun, Will Travel, the TV series. But time-wise, 1915 or whatever, it was prior to that. Did I screw that up? Anyway, how could Shirley MacLaine use that phrase? Is it a common phrase? Maybe something from literature that I don't know about?
Well, I'm not an expert on that particular phrase, but I will tell you that spotting anachronisms on Downton Abbey is a national sport in England, and Americans love to do it too. It's one of my favorite shows, and I love it so much that I tend to overlook these things, but I'm sure you're right, actually. I'm sure that's one of the anachronisms. People have spotted so many. And it's really, I feel for Julian Fellowes because he's such a contemporary writer and such a contemporary sort of a mind. And it's almost irresistible to stick a phrase like that that sounds so American into a show like that to show just how American that character is. I find all of that sort of thing in the show very endearing. It makes me like Julian Fellowes, the writer, more, because I think what he's up against, poor man, you know, trying to write something that everyone is going to enjoy without including anything from out of the time period. I'm sure I couldn't do it, but you're totally right. I'm sure that's a mistake. That can't have been. I can't think of any. Maybe one of the other listeners will say that it was in literature, but nothing that I read included that.
Oh, that's interesting that there are people who are watching to find those anachronisms. Never thought of that.
Yeah, some people only hate watch Downton Abbey just to find those.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yes.
Thanks, John, for the call. Jackie in Barneveld. Hi, Jackie.
Hello, Kathleen.
Oh, Jackie, where are you from?
Well, I'm calling from Barneveld. I'm originally from Leicestershire in the middle of England.
Oh.
And I claim both American and British citizenship these days, having chosen American citizenship since moving here many years ago. But one of the things that I wanted to mention is there's a huge difference between being British and English and in the cultures, and you seem to be using the terms interchangeably.
Right.
And as a Brit abroad, it drives me nuts. Ladies.
I know. I'm sorry. I know.
Because
you'll be happy.
Representative of the United Kingdom.
No, and Erin includes, right. You include that in the book.
In the introduction,
yes.
I give a long description of exactly the difference there, because I know, and it really is very bad. Before I moved to England, I have to admit, I was one of those Americans who did not know the difference, and the book goes into it quite deeply. I did also try to be very careful what I called English in the book and what I called British, but then, this is an interesting thing, when the book went to my British editor, because it's going to come out in England in November, that editor went through and changed many of them. So it's really interesting. So the American editor and the British editor completely disagree. And at this point, I'm letting the British editor do what she'd like because she's from Ireland. She's Irish, and I know that she has some differences of opinion with the American editor. So that's, you're so right to point that out. That's absolutely true.
So how should we be saying things correctly? When do we use British? When do we use English?
English. Well, maybe you would like to tell us.
No, you tell, because I get it all mixed up all the time. I get called on this all the time.
Yes. Well, English is only England. You're only talking about England. And a lot of times, things that we think of as very British are really Southern England. As the caller points out, London is, you know, London is in Southern England. Lots of the things that we talk about when we talk about Britain are sort of Southern English things. And the North has a different culture. It's sort of like in America, the South and the North have different cultures.
Right.
Same there. So it's really interesting. Great Britain, I'm just trying to find this because off the top of my head, I'm terrible.
Well, Great Britain then would be Scotland and Wales and England, and then the UK would include Northern Ireland, right?
Yes, exactly. But you have to be very careful, as the caller says, what you call English and what you call British, because when you say English, you know, some people from Scotland would say, well, hey, wait a minute, we do that too.
Right.
So it's really pretty interesting.
Well, I guess you need a new word. Don't you?
Well, all the right words exist. It's only a matter of parsing which one to use in each situation. And in America, we tend to use them interchangeably, which is wrong.
Thanks, Jackie, very much for the call. Bridget in Janesville, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Bridget.
So, when I was moving here 23 years ago, I had a one-year-old child, and I didn't want him to grow up with a Blackburn accent, so a Northern accent. And so, well, I did, but I didn't really wouldn't have a choice because that's where I was living at the time. But when people said to me, well, aren't you worried that your child will grow up with an American accent? I'm saying, well, I'd rather him have an American accent than a Northern English accent. And now he's 25 and he does have a very American accent. So I was in the opposite position of your guest.
Well, what was wrong with the Northern English accent?
Oh, it's...
sorry.
For me, it made... I don't have a problem with it now, but when I was there, it was like I had a hard time understanding them.
Oh.
And they called me posh because I didn't sound like them.
It was very different.
That accent,
and I feel
too,
like a bit of a snob now for thinking that.
Mm-hmm. Erin.
Oh, well, there can be even a reverse snobbery about accents, that if you were living in the North, people would say, oh, you have such a posh accent. You must be a snob, and it's not really fair. And people in the South can think that people in the North could have a hard time understanding people in the North because it's a much, well, there are a lot of different accents there, but it can be a much thicker accent and not necessarily, well, some people think not a beautiful one. But we have snobbery in America about certain accents as well. But what I find, funny these days, my daughter has developed a London accent, which I can barely tell the difference between a London accent and any other accent of anyone in England. But my my English relatives, that, you know, in the family that I married into, can be really snobby about it. They say, "Oh, she sounds so London," and to me, the difference barely registers. But when they point out what they mean by it, what words she says wrong. I do understand what they're talking about. There is one thing that she says. She will substitute a V sound for a TH sound. She'll say the instead of the, and that is considered very London and considered not beautiful. And I get an earful about that every time we visit.
Thanks so much, Bridget, for your call. Well, let's talk about class for a moment. You mentioned posh. Bridget mentioned posh. You do have in your book middle class as one of the words, because what we think of as middle class and the whole British understanding of class might be quite different.
It is so different, yes. So in America, being middle class, it's aspirational for a lot of people, and being middle class is really about what you earn more than anything. There's pretty good class mobility in America. We still believe, although I hope that this remains true of America, but we still believe in America that you can be or do or have anything you want if you're willing to work hard enough. And that is a value that we teach our children. And in England, being middle class is something that you are born to. So even if in your lifetime if you start out working class, if in your lifetime you earn enough money to join the middle class and buy middle class associated things like middle class education or middle class, I don't know, car or house, your accent will still mark you as part of the working class. There isn't a lot of true class mobility in England in the same way that there is in America. Mm-hmm. So in America, as soon as you've earned a middle class income, you have de facto joined the middle class. Whereas in England, even if income-wise you fall out of the middle class, you will still be identified as middle class by virtue of your accent, maybe the way you dress, the education that you had, the family that you come from. And so it's a little more rigid. The other thing is that the middle class in England can be made fun of in a way that I feel that we don't do with our middle class in America. In America, I feel that we are really sentimental about our middle class. We love the middle class, and we aspire to be part of it. And most people will identify as middle class in America. I've known people who lived in trailer parks and mansions who still called themselves middle class, even though, you know, income-wise, maybe they weren't, because that's what we all consider ourselves practically. Something like 80% of Americans would say that they belong to the middle class. But in England, the middle class, because they were born to it and because they're seen as being, you know, a little bit privileged, and maybe that's not always, maybe they didn't quite earn it sometimes, there's a lot of fun poking that goes on. And the middle class pokes fun at itself as well. There was a class survey that the BBC ran that you could find out what class you were by plugging in some different answers to questions. And someone in the comment section of it in the paper wrote, "If I am middle class, I will fill a 4x4 with organic pesto and drown myself."
Oh my goodness.
Which, you know, as a joke, which I think an American would never say.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting when you think of, in America, you could become president, right? But you can't become the queen in England. There's this whole, I'm sorry, I still don't get it, fascination with the monarchy. And I'll get myself in trouble here because I know a lot of people love the monarchy. But the way they even wouldn't accept Kate until she got close to becoming married here, because she was middle class and she wasn't, I don't know, what wasn't she, upper class? I don't get all of that. I'm sorry.
I know. I don't buy into it. As an American, I find it all a little bit silly, and I don't really buy into it. But when I was a child, my grandmother was a real Anglophile, and she just loved the royal family, and she always read books about them and wanted to watch them on TV. But I think, having lived there now, I can say, no matter what you think of the royal family and the tradition of that, whether you're a monarchist or not, wow, they are the biggest bargain for England. And what they cost England is a fraction of what they bring in, because you think of England, this tiny country. It doesn't have great weather. It is beautiful. It is a beautiful country. It has antiquity, and it has wonderful walks, and it has, actually these days, great food and great beer. But that alone could not account for the millions, millions of worldwide visitors they get a year, and the amount of money that brings into their society, and how well they do from tourism. And I really feel that it's that tradition of the royal family, the changing of the guard, the whole idea of princes and princesses and lords and ladies,
yes.
I think that is bringing them more money and more tourism than, you know, really what the royal family costs.
Fascinating.
Whether you like them or not.
Right, exactly. Let's go to Deb in Milwaukee. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi. I thought it was interesting when Erin was talking earlier about raising her daughter in Britain, or in England, as a British, with a British accent. I have a sister, we grew up in the Chicago area, and I have a sister that moved down to Tennessee many years ago and had kids, and now her kids have a Southern accent. So it's interesting when we go down there, because it's not just going from country to country, but you can do that here in the States as well. Move from one part of the country and raise your kids with a totally different accent.
Right.
It's so true, isn't it? My mother was raised in Savannah, and she moved north when she married my father, moved to Michigan. And people weren't very nice to her about her accent, and she was so self-conscious that everybody always said, oh, you have such a southern accent, that she ended up really losing it. And no one else in the family has had one since.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I was raised without it. But had she been less malleable, she's quite a good mimic, had she been less malleable in her accent, I might speak like a southerner now, which I wouldn't at all mind.
I'm surprised that you've been living in England as long as you have, Erin, and I really don't hear a trace of an accent. Isn't that interesting? You must have worked consciously to stay American in some ways.
Well, I think that it depends on how old you are when you go there. So if you go there much younger, I moved there when I was 30. If you move there much younger, I think that you do naturally. Children are very malleable in their accents. But my feeling when I got there was people see me as so foreign, and I feel so foreign there. What I have ended up doing is, instead of feeling bad about it, like a fish out of water who doesn't belong, what I've ended up doing is completely embracing my own background and my accent and my Americanisms, because I think that the people that I'm friends with like me for those things, you know, like me as I am, and the people who wouldn't like me because of those things, you know, they wouldn't like me if I faked it either. So I guess going over there at 30 and trying to make friends and feeling a little bit foreign, my reaction to that was to embrace my foreignness rather than try to fit in any way. And it's been okay. I've made lots of friends, and I think that, well, I have friends from all over the UK and family as well, and we all understand each other just fine.
And you have a book to boot now, so that's good.
Yeah. They're all really proud. They're so sweet about it. They really are. And they didn't mind being in it, which I appreciate.
That's good.
Not that they had a choice.
Deb, thanks for your call. Camille and Monona, hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
What a wonderful program.
Great.
Just wonderful. I can't wait to go out and get the book. That's Not English. I think I've got that right.
Yes, you do.
I had the pleasure of going to Downton Abbey last year on a tour with Wisconsin Public Television.
Oh, great.
Which was,
you
of course,
so
Public
lucky.
Television made Downton Abbey famous in this country. And we had a great time at Downton Abbey, but then stayed a couple extra days in England. And in terms of language, had an interesting experience. I got a cab from my hotel, and I had been at Harrods the day before, and then I was going to Selfridge's today. And that Mr. Selfridge was also made popular by public television. And I said to the cab driver, I'm going to Selfridge's. And he said, okay. I can't do the English accent. I used to work at Selfridge. And I said, oh, what do you do? What did you do there? I always talk to cab drivers. What did you do there? And he said, I worked in spots. At Harrods, I had seen a big pet department with some spotted Dalmatians the day before. And I said, oh, you worked with pets. You worked with dogs. He said, no, spots. And he then, with his hands, drew a circle like a soccer ball or a football. And I said, oh, sports.
Oh.
You worked in sports. And then he said, yes, you worked in sports. And
how funny.
I said to him, I knew he had been in England. He grew up in England because I'd asked him that the first time. And I said, oh, do you speak English? And we both had a laugh over that because, you know, here it is, English and English.
Right.
And that's the topic of your book, which I'm looking forward to reading.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll enjoy
it. It's so much fun. So much fun talking to taxi drivers. It's one of my favorite pastimes as well. I think you're so lucky to have gotten to go to Highclere. I've been trying to get tickets for the past few years, and I'm always too slow because they sell out really quickly. The Highclere, where Downton Abbey is filmed, is only open for a few months a year to visitors, and people are so dying to go there, including me, that it's very hard to get a ticket.
Mm. Thank you so much, Camille, for the call. And there are other words. You mentioned the word cheers.
Yes.
The English would not use the R, right?
Right. So cheers is one of the words in the book that it has a double meaning. So in America and in England for centuries, it's been used as a toast before drinking. But in England, around the 70s, I was surprised that it was so recent, actually, when I did the research. Around the 70s, it acquired a second meaning, which is a very informal thank you and goodbye. So if you bought a newspaper, or you're getting out of a taxi, or somebody did you a small favor by picking up your scarf from the street that you dropped, you would say cheers. But, I'm terrible at imitating this, I will try.
Okay.
But the English say the word cheers differently in the two contexts. So when they're drinking, they say the R. But when they're saying thank you or goodbye, it's cheers, cheers. And obviously, I can't really do it.
That wasn't bad.
Well, so when Americans adopt that meaning, we don't really get that you're not, that it's a different pronunciation. Anyway, we'd sound silly using the different pronunciation. But so anyway, the English, when they're saying it that way, they have a different pronunciation that we really can't imitate without sounding silly. And I will say that is why I haven't picked up that meaning of cheers in my own speech, because I just feel like I can't say it convincingly. Yeah.
And here's another one. I've always wondered this, too. John from Milwaukee sends this email. Can you ask Aaron why the word schedule, they say what, I can't even say it either. Schedule? Schedule?
Schedule. Yeah, schedule.
Why it's pronounced so differently? There's not a difference in meaning with that word, is there? And why is it so differently pronounced?
There's no difference in meaning, and it is truly just a difference in punctuation. It's truly just a difference in pronunciation. And it's one that drives me a little bit crazy. It's not fair. When people, it never stops sounding strange to me. Never. But it is truly just a difference in pronunciation. Because when Americans came to America, they came to America speaking exactly the way the British at the time were speaking. They came over here, and the two Englishes evolved separately. And America retains some words that the British no longer use, and the English spoken in England acquired some new words too, and the pronunciations diverged. And so now, although we tend to think of English as the mother tongue and American English as the child, the wayward child, it's actually not true. It's more of a sibling situation.
Let's go to Jane in Manitowoc. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Fascinating topic. The word I was going to ask about is bloody, which my understanding is not really a polite word in England. It's more of, I don't know if it's a cuss word, when it crossed over to America, it's just a nondescript word, but in England, it's not a nice word. And
you're
I was wondering
right.
if she has an explanation or
she
any
does.
Background on that.
She does.
Yes.
It's in the book.
Yes, there's a whole chapter on bloody, and it's all about cursing and how it's different between the two countries. And bloody, these days, it's an all-purpose intensifier that we, in America, we don't think of it as being a very strong word because it's played for laughs in a lot of British movies, and we hear it and we think it doesn't sound, it sounds very, very British, but it doesn't sound like such a dirty word. But according to the Oxford English Dictionary, bloody once qualified as the absolute strongest expletive available in just about every English-speaking nation except the United States.
Hmm.
So actually in 1914, George Bernard Shaw used it in his play Pygmalion, and it was very controversial.
Oh.
And a newspaper at the time called the Daily Express went out and interviewed an actual Cockney flower girl and asked her if an actual Cockney flower girl would use that word, and she said, absolutely not. That was a filthy word.
Uh-huh.
And it was considered very offensive. But these days in England, it's been so overused that it's really not considered as offensive, but you still would not want to use it in front of anyone you were trying to impress or, say, your friend's grandmother.
Erin Moore, our guest, her book is That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. She has been living in London for 8 years now. Her daughter is much more English than she in terms of the choice of words and the way that she speaks and the accent that she has. She grew up in America, our guest. Her husband was born in England and traveled with his parents. She was born and raised in South Florida, and she says the Epcot Center was the closest she got to an international experience before the age of 20, but she's been living there for 8 years now, and they'll be raising their children there. So the book is fascinating. It's picked, she went through a whole lot of words and picked quite a few of them that not only show about the differences in culture and use of words in just the existence of a certain word, it also, as words tend to do, explains a whole lot about a culture and a country's history. So that's what the book is about. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Hi, Camille.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
This is so interesting. What I have always wanted to ask someone is whether or not the spoken grammatical errors that we make influence each other at all. For example, the way Americans say different than instead of different from, or they say literally when they really mean figuratively, or any grammatical errors that we make commonly, do they start to float over to England or vice versa?
Oh, that's a really good question. And in individual cases, I think they probably do. American English has a huge influence in England because all of our television shows, all of our movies, all of our music are just wall to wall there. It's not something that you can opt out of there the way British culture is for Americans. So if you're an Anglophile in America, you can pick and choose what aspects of that cultural output to look at, like Downton Abbey or, you know, the Beatles or whatever. But if you are English, American culture and American English is kind of for some people oppressive, you know, and they hear errors like that and get upset because they think, oh, American English is corrupting British English. But there are things that the British say that are correct over there that sound wrong to our ears. For example, another call-in show that I did, somebody brought up the point that people in England say someone is in the hospital,
yes,
instead of in the hospital. And we got into a big, long conversation about it. And the reason why that is that in England, there's a distinction between just in hospital. If you say they're in the hospital, you're specifying a specific hospital. That's when everyone in on the conversation knows which hospital you're talking about. So I have been there for 8 years, but anytime someone says, oh, he's in hospital, it just sounds so wrong to me. I'm just looking for the.
Yes.
But generally to say someone's in hospital is correct. And just like some of our grammatical errors in America have just become so institutionalized among people that they stop sounding like errors. For example, the plural they, when you're talking about an individual, for example, you said someone went to the movies, they sat in the front row.
Mm-hmm.
That's one that drives me crazy, but I've heard arguments made even among copy editors for making that okay, for making that one official because it's so common. I would argue against that, but I think that in America we're so influential and you don't even realize how influential our English is.
The other one that you hear so frequently from newscasters is graduate college or graduate university, graduate high,
yes,
school, instead of from. That drives,
yes,
me crazy too.
Yes, always will sound wrong to me as well.
Right. What do you think of the word gobsmacked? We didn't hear that here forever, and now all of a sudden it's creeping into our speech.
Yes. Well, gobsmacked literally means a gob. A gob is a sort of archaic slang for mouth. And so literally the word means, I am so surprised. It is like somebody smacked me in the mouth. And so once you know that, it's hard to hear the word gobsmacked and like it. But
right.
In England, that word started in the northern part of England. It was a slang term that originated there and filtered south. And when it got to the south, to London and environs, that is where most of the British media is based. You know, all of the major newspapers television, that sort of thing, are in London. And so once the Southerners picked up on it, then it got exported because Americans consume a lot of the what is produced in London as far as media is concerned. But also, as we discussed before, a lot of English people end up running American media outlets, magazines in particular. There are tons of English editors in America, a couple of newspapers, some TV shows. But the main point at which Gobsmacked is supposed to have come to America is that show, I'm going to forget the name of it, but where people sing and Simon Cowell dissects them on television.
What is American Idol.
Yes. That woman, Susan Boyle, shocked everyone by singing such a perfect rendition of that that song from Les Miserables.
Mm-hmm.
And after she won, she was interviewed a lot of times by the American media, and she said, "I'm gobsmacked.
Oh,
I'm simply gobsmacked." And it was just the word that she kept using and using and using, and people picked up on it, and now Americans are using it more.
Oh, yeah, that is where it came from.
It's not my favorite word.
Right. You include this quote in the book, but I think that the reference of who said it is somewhat vague. Maybe we've nailed it down. Pam says in Appleton, remember Oscar Wilde once said that England and America were two countries separated by a common language. Was it Wilde who said that?
Well, I found arguments made for George Bernard Shaw and Oscar Wilde, and I actually couldn't confirm it. So when I used that quote in my book, I said it could have been either of them, but regardless of who said it, that is a line that trivializes the problem. You know, we say that our two countries are separated by a common language. I think that that really that's an understatement along British lines.
Pam writes on Facebook, I blame the Brits for spreading online rather than standing in line, and Gone Missing for Is Missing. Both date back to the 70s and have crept here slowly but surely.
She's completely right. And if anybody's interested in more words like that, Ben Yagoda has the most wonderful blog called Not One Off Britishisms, Noob for short, N-O-O-B. And he tracks the rise of Britishisms in American language So minutely. He uses Google tracking to find instances of them. He can tell you when all of these words came to America, how often they've been used, and when the spikes have been and why. His blog was a terrific source of research for me, and I recommend it to anyone who's interested in this.
And finally, Barbara in Fond du Lac. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm an expat Brit who's been resident in the U.S. for a long time, and I grew up in the north of England with one of those despised northern accents. But my father moved around a lot, so I ended up in a family of five people, each of whom spoke differently from the others.
Oh.
We sounded like a cross patch of everything British.
Wow.
The thing is, hello?
Yes, we're here.
Oh, you're there. Okay. The thing is, even after living here so long, practically every time I open my mouth, someone will say to me, "Ooh, I love the way you talk. Say something." In a previous job I had a part-time job in an antique mall. One of the women there said to me one day, "Aren't you sick of people asking you that?" And I said, "Well, yes, after close to 40 years, it's not new to me, but one cannot be rude. They're, you know, being friendly and helpful. But I wish I had a nickel for every time somebody had asked me that or commented on it." And then I hesitate to tell them that they may like the way I speak, but in the UK, I'm right working class from the north of England.
Isn't that interesting? But here you're very polished, because it sounds very polished. She sounds very polished, doesn't she?
Well, Americans find, I think, that all British accents of all kinds sound more alike each other than they sound like our own.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really can't make those distinctions that you would make if you were from there. And I like that. I think probably that's a nice thing. But it would really drive me crazy, I have to admit, if every time I opened my mouth, someone said, "Oh, you sound so posh and intelligent. Would you please repeat what you just said? It really would make me crazy.
I feel for
people in America who have to go through that, because Americans do so love that accent.
I know.
All of them.
And I do that all the time on the air. I hear an accent, I'll say, oh, where are you from? I'm sure they're so sick of hearing that, but they're new to my ears. Thanks so much for the call. Well, the book is just delightful and informative as well, Erin. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
It has been fun. Erin Moore, her book is That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Great conversations ahead, and we'll be with you again on Monday. So cheers.